But without further ado, let me introduce Bob McGrath, a former president and now a director.
Okay, thank you, Rich. It's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Nicole Hemmer is an assistant professor in presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. She's an expert on the history of American politics and media, and she works on a wide-ranging set of projects, both scholarly and public. I actually don't know how she does all the things she does. At the Miller Center, she works in the Presidential Recording Program, focusing on the Nixon administration and its media relations. Her broader scholarship focuses on the history of conservatism and the media. Her first book, titled Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, charts the history of conservative media activism in the United States. And her current work in progress is a history of conservatism in the 1990s. Probably a number of us also had the opportunity to listen to Nicole at the Miller Center's Prez Fest a few weeks ago at the University of Virginia. She not only moderated one of the panels, but she also was a panel participant. She appears frequently in print and on the air. She's founder and editor of the Washington Post's Made by History blog, a contributing editor to Vox, and she also writes a syndicated column for Fairfax Media in Australia. She co-hosts and produces the popular history podcast called Past Present. Her commentary on U.S. politics has appeared in many national and international outlets, including the New York Times, Politico, The Atlantic, New Republic, Vox, Los Angeles Times, and NPR's Morning Edition. She holds an appointment as a research associate at the United States Studies Center at the University of Sydney in Australia, where she was a postdoctoral fellow. She received her PhD in U.S. history from Columbia University and previously taught at the University of Miami. In 2015, she was a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. She covered the events of August 11 and 12, 2017, for Vox. She is the creator, producer, and host of the podcast series A12, The Story of Charlottesville. This was named by The Guardian as one of the best podcasts of 2018. Now, on a personal note, I don't need The Guardian to tell me that podcast series was fantastic. Last summer, just before the one-year anniversary of the events in Charlottesville, my wife and I were driving back here, and we stopped at a hotel overnight about 6 hours from here. And happily, or fortunately, that morning I was reading the New York Times online, and I read a rave review about her podcast series. I quickly downloaded it, and we spent the entire drive back to Charlottesville absolutely engrossed and enlightened by the deep and comprehensive coverage that her podcast series gave. So I'm really looking forward to hearing her talk more about this. We're fortunate to have Professor Hemmer with us today to tell us about, the title is, When the Fascists Came to Town, Charlottesville and the Rise of the Alt-Right. Let's welcome her.
Thank you for that extraordinarily kind introduction. There was a wave of excitement rippling through the white vans carrying marchers to downtown Charlottesville on the morning of April 12, 2017. The night before, they had gathered in dark and marched under flickering torchlight, but that morning they would assemble in the full light of day, faces clear and bright under the midday sun when the rally kicked off at noon. The look on their faces was not one of anger or hate, but one of joy and celebration. And that's because Charlottesville was the alt-right's coming out party. For nearly a decade, the alt-right had been largely an online phenomenon, a growing network of white supremacists, men's rights activists, anti-Semites, and others who sought to craft an alternative to American conservatism. The Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville was supposed to be the moment that the alt-right crossed over into the real world, demonstrating its physical presence and political power in the aftermath of President Donald Trump's election. But why did they choose Charlottesville, of all places, to take their stand? Part of it is an accident of biography. Two major leaders of the alt-right called Charlottesville home at various points. But it is also a product of history. Racism, white supremacy, activism, and diversity have shaped Charlottesville from its beginning. And for centuries, it has been a town struggling to tell an honest version of its past, a struggle that continues to this day. So today I'd like to dig more into this history and the way that the city memorializes its history as a way of understanding the paths that brought the alt-right to Charlottesville 2 years ago. So there are two ways to tell the history of Charlottesville. One goes like this. Charlottesville began as a home of presidents and explorers. Both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison lived in the county, and James Monroe lived not far away. You've no doubt seen the three presidents in their statuary on the downtown mall. In 1803, Jefferson needed someone to explore the vast new lands he had just purchased from France. And so he commissioned Meriwether Lewis, another Charlottesville native, to head west and map the continent. The Lewis and Clark Expedition, the first of its kind, charted the vast frontier from St. Louis to the Pacific Northwest. In the 19th century, Charlottesville also staked a claim as a center of commerce and education. The University of Virginia, Jefferson's crown jewel, sat on open lands west of town. The Civil War left the city conquered, but not razed, and over the course of the 20th century, Charlottesville grew in wealth and culture. After some mild unpleasantness around the issue of civil rights, it healed its racial divisions and began to prosper. By the early 21st century, it had become the ideal university town, progressive, wealthy, diverse, and thriving. I have heard this story a lot over the 4 years that I've lived in Charlottesville, and I'm sure you all have too. But it's far from the most interesting story of Charlottesville's past, and it's far from the most accurate one. The other story of Charlottesville begins not with Jefferson, but with a Monacan village displaced by white settlement. It is the story of Sally Hemings and the enslaved people of Monticello. It is the story of Sacagawea, the Shoshone woman hired to guide Lewis and Clark across the continent. It is the story of the Jewish merchants who labored to make this place a city. And it is the story of the black men and women, free and enslaved, who at the time of the Civil War made up the majority of Charlottesville's population. I wondered what the history of Charlottesville would look like if we told their stories too. When I dug into the stories that went beyond the town's official narrative, I discovered a diverse city marked by both discrimination and resilience. In the 19th century, Charlottesville was a small town serving the vast plantation economy of Albemarle County. The town's free people were overwhelmingly white and Christian. But at the time of the Civil War, there were several hundred free black people who lived here, as well as a handful of Jewish citizens. And that was a real rarity in the South. There were not a lot of Jewish congregations across the American South in the 19th century. And there weren't a ton of Jewish residents in Charlottesville in the 19th century, but they really made a place for themselves as the town's primary merchants. Their businesses put them at the middle of the heart of life here in Charlottesville. And according to Dr. Phyllis Leffler, who is a professor emerita at the University of Virginia, they actually faced very little anti-Semitism in the 19th century, in large part because their small numbers meant they weren't seen as a threat to the white Christian community. These Southern Jews were attracted, at least in part, by Thomas Jefferson's efforts to safeguard religious freedom. And so while Charlottesville was a land of the slave owners and the enslaved, it was also the home to David Isaacs and Nancy West Isaacs, who lived next to one another on Main Street. David Isaacs, a Jewish merchant, ran a dry goods store. Nancy, his common-law wife, who's described in sources as mulatto, sold baked goods and owned significant real estate in the area. But Charlottesville was hardly a mecca of tolerance and liberty. Because in the 19th century, the real heart of Charlottesville wasn't the merchants on Main Street. It was slavery. At the beginning of the 19th century, white Virginians enslaved around 350,000 people, a number that would grow to nearly 500,000 by the start of the Civil War. Yet it was in danger of losing its status as the largest slaveholding state in the Union, not because enslavers had suddenly grown a conscience, but because the real money was no longer in Virginia's tired soils. It was in the frontier land of Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Texas, and Louisiana. Between 1820 and 1860, enslavers sold 500,000 people out of Virginia, ripping apart families, communities, and friends. And many of those people were auctioned off right here in downtown Charlottesville. Enslaved people weren't just the heart of Charlottesville's economy, they were the heart of its population. At the time of the Civil War, 52% of the county's residents were enslaved, about 14,000 people. Another 600 were free blacks. And those numbers matter because for over a century, the story of Charlottesville in the Civil War was told as a story of defeat, a southern city conquered. But for the majority of the city, the arrival of Union troops marked not defeat, but liberation. Enslaved people flocked to the United States soldiers, emancipating themselves in the process. And Professor John Mason, who is a history professor at UVA, loves to tell this story that he found in the archives in a letter from one of the U.S. soldiers who wrote about an enslaved woman here in Charlottesville who ran to greet him when they arrived in the town with a big tray full of cookies. So here she was, rushing to greet them as liberators and to feed them, because that's what we do for the people in our lives. And these are the kinds of stories that we don't know, because they're the stories that are never told about Charlottesville. That's because the memory of Charlottesville has largely been centered around the white residents here. And white history has dominated because of what happened after emancipation. Freedom quickly faded. Though black men in Charlottesville did vote in the decades after the Civil War, white Charlottesvillians worked to end that. In Virginia's 1902 Constitution, there was a new literacy requirement put in place, as well as a poll tax, which disenfranchised more than 90% of Charlottesville's black men. White people in Charlottesville did not just rely on the law to regain their power after the war. They also used violence. In 1898, a black man named John Henry James was accused of assaulting a white woman, one of the most common pretexts for violence against black men. James was arrested and then taken to a nearby town to appear before the magistrate, but the train transporting him back to Charlottesville was stopped at the Woods Cross Station, just outside of town, and a white mob surrounded it. They dragged James from the train, hung him from the tree, and shot him more than 70 times. And this is how that was covered in white versus black papers. You might not be able to see this, but in the Iowa County Democrat, picking up the reporting that was coming out of Charlottesville, the story appears under the headline, "Colored Brute Lynched." In the Richmond Planet, a black newspaper, the title is, "They Lynched Him. Died Protesting Innocence, a Brutal Murder. Mob Makes No Effort at Disguise." And the mob did make no effort at disguise, but they were not punished, and they knew they wouldn't be punished. They knew what we have sometimes forgotten, how white rule would be reestablished through violence and with a nodding wink from the justice system. And black Charlottesvillians got the message too. Violence took the form of lynching in the 1890s and beyond. But it also took the form of the Ku Klux Klan, which reemerges in Charlottesville in 1921. And some of the most prominent people in the town end up joining the Klan. You can see the robes at the Charlottesville Historical Society. And they didn't just target black Charlottesvillians. They also targeted the city's Jewish population. If Jews in Charlottesville felt comfortable in the 19th century, in the 20th century, they did not. They were under new assault from groups like the Klan. Cross burnings and white supremacist rallies became a feature of life in Charlottesville in the 1920s. Jim Crow segregation had solidified white power in the city. But to tell the story of Black and Jewish Charlottesville in the 20th century as a story of oppression is to actually miss the most important part of the story. Charlottesville's Jews formed a community centered at the Congregation Beth Israel, a synagogue that still serves the city's Jews. And Black people remained nearly half of the population into the early 20th century. And they built a vibrant community at the heart of Charlottesville in a neighborhood called Vinegar Hill. So Vinegar Hill was both the residential and commercial heart of Black Charlottesville. The neighborhood once sat right next to downtown and hosted every kind of business imaginable. It had barbershops and pool rooms and grocery stores and banks and insurance companies. Rental properties and homes filled the rest of the neighborhood. Black students attended Jefferson Elementary School in Vinegar Hill. There was no Black high school. Black high schoolers whose families could afford to would send them to neighboring counties to get an education. But Black businesses thrived, as did opportunities for wealth. At one point, nearly 40% of the real estate in Vinegar Hill was owned by a Black woman named Nancy Cox Jackson, who was a school teacher. She died in 1963 with an estate worth over $1 million. So there really was an opportunity to thrive economically, even within this segregated system. As many of you may know, in the 1950s and the 1960s, this is difficult to read, but it is a sign for the urban renewal of Vinegar Hill. It's called Vinegar Hill Redevelopment. Urban renewal actually destroys Vinegar Hill, and with it, the heart of the Black community. And urban renewal in Charlottesville, like elsewhere across the country, targeted Black neighborhoods. This all came on the heels of years of massive resistance. When Charlottesville closed its schools rather than allow African American students to integrate. So those two processes, Jim Crow segregation and urban renewal, eviscerate Black Charlottesville. And Charlottesville goes from a city with a Black population of 50% to a Black population today of under 20%. So during a period that is often told to us as this time of prosperity and growth, for the city's Black community, it was a story of attrition. Indeed, Charlottesville as it is today required the destruction of Vinegar Hill and the Black population. Their removal was the foundation of the charming, progressive city that emerged in the decades that followed. Now, there is one exception to this story of loss, and that is the university. While the city of Charlottesville was pushing out its Black residents, the university was slowly expanding, starting to make more space for what had been almost exclusively white, male, and Christian students. According to Phyllis Loeffler, the experience for Jews improved dramatically at the university after 1950. In addition to admitting more Jewish students, women are allowed to go to the University of Virginia after 1970. And in 1969, UVA has a Black student population of about 1%. That rapidly changes as well, and they begin opening their doors to Black students as well. And that actually triggers a new era of Black student activism. That's the heart of Black activism, really in Charlottesville for some years. It starts in the 1960s and 1970s. So even as the city itself is losing its Black population, over on grounds, young Black students have been continuing that fight for change. And it's something that continues to this day. Quite a lot of activism from Black students at the university. So if you tell the history of Charlottesville as the gradual creation of a progressive town, you're not exactly wrong. Right, this is a city that is heavily Democratic. 85% of its residents voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. It is a progressive city. And yet it is also a city that was built on exclusion. The economic heart of Black Charlottesville was destroyed in the 1960s, and that combined with the Great Migration guts the Black population. So if you never go beyond the carefully manicured landscapes and histories of Charlottesville, you'll never really understand the kind of traumas that were at the heart of the battles over the city statuary, or what happened over the course of what is known locally among activists as the Summer of Hate, these sprawling months of clashes between activists and white supremacists in 2017. And yet very, very few Charlottesvillians know the town's full history. And part of the reason for that is because the history told in our parks and in our streets and in our monuments is incomplete and sometimes even just wrong. Most of you have probably been to downtown Charlottesville, and if you have been there and walked its beautiful red brick sidewalks, then you have probably at one point in time stood near or on the city's largest monument to slavery. It is the slave auction block. Underneath it says, on this site, slaves were bought and sold. It's about 1 foot square, and it's embedded at street level. So you can it's actually in this picture, but you can't see it because it's flush with the sidewalk. That is very different from the other historical monuments that you will see if you walk down Jefferson Street. In fact, you will pass down, past three pretty majestic statues, one representing Confederate soldiers. If you've looked at the Confederate soldier statue, there's a plaque on it that says, Confederate soldiers, defenders of the rights of the states. One depicts Stonewall Jackson, and another depicts Robert E. Lee. And there's a real difference between this and this, in what people see when they walk through the streets of Charlottesville. And because of that, back in 2012, a city councilor named Kristen Sackos spoke up about the statues. She argued that these were statues not to the Confederacy, but to white supremacy and slavery. And she traced their history to Paul McIntyre, a very wealthy man who gave the land and the statues to the city in the 1920s to celebrate the history of the city's white citizens. And in 2012, this goes absolutely nowhere. She makes no headway in city council to talk about these statues. But the Charleston massacre of 2015 changes that. You all no doubt remember when white nationalist Dylann Roof murdered 9 African Americans at a prayer meeting. And that really did change the conversation around the Confederacy and how we remember it. Confederate flags began to come down across the nation, and some people began to wonder, well, maybe these statues should come down too. And in Charlottesville, that push gains new life thanks to Zy Bryant. Bryant, who's Black, was just 15 when she started a petition calling for the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue. And she found a backer in West Bellamy. In 2016, Bellamy, who was also Black, joined the city council and became the youngest vice mayor in the city's history. And together, Bryant and Bellamy represented a voice that hadn't been heeded in Charlottesville in a very long time, if ever. The voice of young Black people. They oversaw a moment of genuine change and discussion, and it starts a debate about, okay, what do we do about these statues? And that led to the founding of the Blue Ribbon Commission on Race, Memorials, and Public Statues, who kind of took a step back and they said, okay, well, let's just look at Charlottesville and look at the history that it tells in its streets. Because actually, these Confederate statues weren't the only statue battles that have happened in Charlottesville. The first statues battle happened several years before. A few steps from the downtown mall, you might know this statue, another statue protrudes from the middle of a busy intersection. It portrays Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, and there, crouching at their heels, is Sacagawea. Look, she is almost invisible from any angle in this statue, and she is in, as you can tell, a really diminished position. She's holding one of the explorer's hands. And some people got upset about this diminished depiction of Sacagawea. And they acted. In 2011, students at Tandem Friends, which you may know as the city's Quaker school, fought back with an art project. They commandeered the wall of a nearby building, and they painted a mural of 2 Native American men gazing scornfully at the statue. This is actually a pretty cool way to do this. If you can't move a statue, and spoiler alert, so far, not a lot of luck moving statues in Charlottesville, you can make it a more interactive piece of art. You may have seen this with the statue of the little girl facing down the Wall Street Bull, which really changes the image of the Wall Street Bull, because now all of the focus is on that little girl standing up to him. And this changes it as well, right? That you have this sign of judgment, of leveling of that statue, of an interaction and a message with that statue. To see that mural now, though, you have to go down a dark alleyway. That's because developers built a residence inn next to the mural in 2016. And in doing so, they blocked it off. And so, like, you can walk down Main Street, you can peek in, but that interactivity is no longer there. The Sacagawea statue still is there. And that says something about the limits of this kind of interactive art. And there have been other attempts to tell the fuller story of Charlottesville as well, that also just don't go very well. The Drury Brown Memorial Bridge has plaques on it that are dedicated to the city's civil rights leaders. Until I started this project, I had walked down that bridge maybe 100 times and never noticed any of these plaques. Again, they're small. The plaques to the different civil rights leaders only have their names and don't have any information about who the people are. There's also a plaque to Vinegar Hill. For a long time, they put a trash can in front of it, so you couldn't actually see it. And even though they've moved some of these planters and things out of the way so that you can see the sign, again, this is a very small marker of violence done against a very big neighborhood and a very big part of Charlottesville. And this is very different from this, right? There's no equality between these two ways of memorializing the city. So to this extent that Charlottesville has tried to tell a more inclusive story, it's failed. So what about the stories behind, the history behind the stories that the city does tell? Well, there's some really interesting investigation that went into these Confederate statues. During the 2016 and 2017 debates, activists used the historical record to raise some questions about what those statues were doing. They noted first and foremost that Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson never set foot in Charlottesville. These are not exactly native sons. And they noted that the statues went up in the 1920s, when the Klan flourished in Charlottesville, and when African Americans lost power in the city, as racist massacres were happening across the country in places like Tulsa and Charleston. And these arguments worked. In February of 2017, the city council voted to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee. And then a few weeks later, a court issued an injunction preventing the city from removing the statues, which still stand to this day. And so one thing that activists have tried to do is try to balance out the statues. If you can't remove them, how can you tell a better and fuller story of the city of Charlottesville? Well, one way to do that is by memorializing the victims of white nationalism, which there are more today than there were. This includes a new monument to John Henry James, who was, again, a local victim of lynching. In July, people from Charlottesville journeyed to Montgomery, Alabama, where the new lynching museum had just opened. And this new museum is actually extremely cool because of its interactivity. So one thing that the residents of Charlottesville did was they brought soil from the site of the lynching that will then go on display in this lynching museum. So they brought something there, and they took something home. Because the other thing that the lynching museum has is it has all of these monuments to every single victim of lynching. And you have a choice as a city as to whether you're going to claim that and put it up in your town. So it's giving cities a way of bringing a memorial home so that a conversation about lynching can continue on site. And if you go there and you can see which cities have not claimed their lynching memorials. So again, it's an incredibly innovative way of telling new histories. Another way that activists looked to interact with the statues were actually kind of cool. Margot Smith launched the Kudzu Project, in 2017. It was a guerrilla knitting installation intended to draw attention to Confederate monuments around Virginia. So what the group does is they knit these blankets that look like kudzu vines, and they go around and they throw them over Confederate statues as a way of kind of both concealing the statues, but also saying, this is a part of the Old South. This is a part of history that just needs to be reclaimed by nature, like kudzu overgrowing something and taking it over. A way of saying that these statues need to be consigned to the dustbins of history. And I think that this work of the Kudzu Project and a real resistance toward it, people don't like this, shows how live these battles over history still are. But of course, we don't need those reminders, because in 2017, the debate over the statues was how Charlottesville became a target of the alt-right. So since 2008, a UVA graduate named Richard Spencer emerged as a leader of the alt-right. He rose to national prominence during the 2016 campaign, and he remained in the spotlight after Donald Trump's election. At a rally in front of the White House to oppose the bombing of Syria in early 2017, he met a young alt-right acolyte named Jason Kessler. So Kessler is a native Charlottesvillian who had been making a name for himself here in the city. He largely did that by going to war with Vice Mayor Wes Bellamy, who had become advocating for the removal of these two Confederate statues. Because Bellamy was a leading advocate for the statues' removal, Kessler began targeting him, looking for ways to unseat him. But he also wanted to use the statue debate as a focal point for the alt-right movement. He believed that if he connected with Spencer and they focused together on Charlottesville, he could move up in the alt-right leadership and that they could bond over their mutual connection to Charlottesville. So again, Spencer, a graduate of UVA, Kessler, a member of the Charlottesville community. And Spencer, too, was already looking south toward Charlottesville. Confederate statues had long blurred the line between white supremacy and regional pride. They were a way of gaining some kind of plausible deniability for white supremacists who wanted to use the statues as the center point for a new fight. In many ways, the turn to the statues controversy here in Charlottesville represented a pivot away from the Trump campaign and toward a battle that would connect them with a deeper American history and a new audience ripe for radicalization. So on May 13th, 2017, this is really the first time that the so-called Summer for Hate, Summer of Hate begins. Spencer joins Mike Enoch, who's a neo-Nazi blogger and podcaster, and 100 or so other self-identified members of the alt-right in Charlottesville. They come during the Festival of Cultures, a celebration of the town's diversity, which was held in Lee Park, in the shadow of the statue of Robert E. Lee. The white supremacists crowded around the Germany table in a tribute to Adolf Hitler, then made their way to Jackson Park and to the statue of Stonewall Jackson, where they made speeches. And these speeches, which you can see on YouTube, are full-throated declarations of white supremacy. They are not trying to hide or temper their politics. They say that they are there to defend the white race and to defend white heroes. And they made clear that the fight was not just about the statues. It was about white heroes, it was about white history, and it was about defending white people from an effort to stamp out white culture. He put in bold terms what defenders of the Confederacy seldom stated or even acknowledged, the deeply racist history behind the statues and their subjects. And if the daytime event was about white supremacy, the nighttime event was about white power. May 13th, 2017 was the first time that the alt-right brought their torches to Charlottesville. They circled the statue of Robert E. Lee, chanting blood and soil, and you will not replace us. 2 weeks later, Jason Kessler filed for a permit for a rally in Lee Park, scheduled for August 12th, the Unite the Right rally. As you can see from here, they drew very heavily from Nazi-style iconography. The Unite the Right rally was billed as a free speech event with two overarching goals: to forge a broad right-wing coalition that included the alt-right, and to frame the group's organizing as a testament to the left's intolerance for the First Amendment. So this was going to be a free speech event, and they wanted to illustrate that the left would not tolerate their speech. What it ended up doing instead was shattering the alt-right coalition and associating it irredeemably with terroristic violence. So everything that happened in May, plus this gathering scheduled for the 12th, that really includes violent white nationalists. Like, there was the lineup for this event made it clearly not just a white supremacist event, but a white power violent event. That put white supremacy at the heart of Charlottesville activism. The ostensible aims of the Unite the Right rally, building a coalition, defending free speech, protecting Confederate statues, that continued across the summer to shape the ways that the alt-right looked at Charlottesville, including the rules around it. Participants were told, they didn't listen, they were told not to do Nazi salutes, not to bring Nazi flags. They worked closely with law enforcement in the months leading up to the event. And they expected a scene of stark contrast. They thought that what it was going to look like was the alt-right gathered in Lee Park, very peacefully giving speeches, and police and protesters surrounding the park fighting. And that was going to be the sign that the intolerant left did not accept free speech, and so everybody who agrees with free speech should join the alt-right. And that planned symbolism was really important because for months the alt-right had been honing a set of arguments meant to make the movement more mainstream. Wanting only their God-given right to speak freely, the alt-right had revealed the intolerance, violence, and un-Americanness of a left that refused to let them speak. And this is an incredibly smart tactic. This kind of reframing means that you're not talking about white supremacy versus anti-racism, you're talking about free speech versus censorship. And if you reframe it that way, then the alt-right is on the side of the angels. This has worked, by the way, extremely effectively elsewhere. Such a plan could have succeeded, but was dramatically undercut by the decision to hold an unannounced torchlight march on August 11th, the night before the Unite the Right rally, which I don't think I included pictures of. This torchlight march is incredibly important. It began as an act of political intimidation. It ended as an act of political violence, as hundreds of white men and a handful of white women marched onto the University of Virginia's campus with no prior notice and no authorization, shouting slogans like "Jews will not replace us." When they arrived at their intended rallying point, the statue of Thomas Jefferson, outside the university's famed rotunda, they found a small group of anti-racist students and activists circling the statue. The alt-right marchers surrounded the protesters and then began to beat them as the police who were nearby looked on. The torchlight march unmade the argument, defended in courts just hours earlier, that the Unite the Right rally was about political speech rather than political violence. So at 8 p.m., just like an hour and a half before this march onto campus, U.S. District Court Judge Glenn Conrad had sided with the American Civil Liberties Union on free speech and free assembly grounds to allow the rally to be held in downtown Charlottesville. There had been a case to move it over to McIntyre Park so that the violence could be contained or that there wouldn't be a clash between protesters and alt-right activists. Less than 2 hours later, the torchlight march showed that the judge had made a real mistake, that the core issues really were public safety, because the alt-right activists were planning to engage in political violence. This was not going to be a free speech rally. They had already come prepared to do intimidation and violence. And yet the court order stood. No new order was issued, and the rally was allowed to proceed as planned. So by the next morning, by the time August 12th dawns, by the time those guys are getting into their vans and driving to downtown Charlottesville, none of the premises that the Unite the Right rally were built on were intact. Rather than uniting a broad right-wing coalition around issues of Confederate nostalgia and white rights, the organizers had exposed the sharp limits of a movement that openly displayed Nazi symbols and challenged anti-Semitic slurs. Not a lot of people wanted to join these guys. The violence at the Rotunda had exposed the inauthenticity of the free speech claims and made it impossible to pin the violence of the day on anti-racist and anti-fascist counter-protesters. Even had the rest of the day gone as planned, even if they had the white supremacists and neo-Confederates and neo-Nazis given their speeches, they marched in and out of the park under police protection, the rally was already a failure on its declared terms. It didn't unite the right, and it wasn't about free speech. Of course, the rally didn't go on as planned. As the speakers huddled in the rear of the park, alt-right supporters and white supremacist activists, many of them armed, gleefully clashed with counter-protesters, unimpeded by the massive police presence that circled the downtown area. When the park was cleared well in advance of the planned starting time, white supremacists rolled through the city's narrow streets. One group savagely beat counter-protester DeAndre Harris in a parking garage next to the police station, in what was, at that moment, the bloodiest violence of the day. A little over 90 minutes later, at 1:41 p.m., 20-year-old James Alex Fields Jr., who earlier in the day had been seen carrying a shield with the emblem of Vanguard America, a neo-Nazi organization, sped his gray Dodge Charger into a crowd of protesters, killing an activist named Heather Heyer and injuring dozens of others in an act of terroristic violence. A year and a half later, Fields pled guilty to 29 federal hate crime charges. Charlottesville is a place with a complicated history, one that has been contested for centuries. That contest has put it at the center of contemporary battles over white supremacy and multiculturalism, and led 2 years ago to it being the site of one of the most dramatic white power terrorist attacks in recent history. The statues in the center of Charlottesville tell a lie about the city's past, just as white supremacists tell a lie about race and power. That's why they were so attracted to the battle over the statues here. The events of the Summer of Hate call upon us to reckon honestly with the history of Charlottesville, to acknowledge the role of enslavement and white supremacy, as well as the contributions of Jewish, Black, and Native people to building and sustaining the city. Our landscape doesn't yet tell that story, but hopefully one day it will. Because as we learned 2 years ago, the histories we tell have high stakes, and they're worth fighting for. Thanks.
Jim is telling me I should be doing this. Anyway, because this is a podcast series about a podcast, you need to have a microphone before you ask your question, please. So raise your hand and we'll send a mic to you. So who wants to ask the first question?
Thank you. There was a ProPublica and Frontline report where a very intrepid reporter traced down some of these folks and the gang-like, I guess, atmosphere that surrounded them on the West Coast was really rather striking. Do you have anything you can add about that story?
Yeah, I mean, these are essentially white supremacist or white power gangs. One of those gangs that disavowed formally the events in Charlottesville, but their members, including Jason Kessler, were a big part of it, is something called the Proud Boys. They now brand themselves as alt-light instead of alt-right. But, I mean, think about the way that they operate. To become a member of the Proud Boys, you have to be beaten in, which is to say you have to be beat up by the other members. This is a classic gang organization loyalty membership ritual. And it is unsurprising in a group that really not only emphasizes white supremacy, but emphasizes male supremacy, that this kind of physical violence and sort of like male toughness is at the heart of it. But these are exactly, I mean, with their symbology, with their iconography, with their, they have outfits that they wear. Like, this is very classic gang behavior. And it's a big organizing model for white supremacists. I should add, just as you're getting another question, that's one model of white power activism. Kathleen Ballou, who is a historian of white power activism in the United States, also notes that starting in the 1980s, there has also been a shift towards something called leaderless resistance, which is to say that within the more violent sectors of the white power movement, they basically operate as terror cells, where one hand doesn't know what the other is doing. So it looks like a lone wolf, but they're all connected in these cells. So that's another model that's out there as well, and a really powerfully important one.
Is this on? Yeah. Related to the previous question, we saw that Frontline program a year ago, the night before we listened to your podcast. And after watching the Frontline program, we were massively depressed. It appeared that there was nothing to do to stop the alt-right and so forth and so on in their organization. And your last episode in A12, you had an interview with Phil Zelikow about some legal actions that had been effective in thwarting some of the more militant aspects of the alt-right. And it seemed to us that that was not only a little bit of optimistic note on things, but that it might be being effective in damping down all this stuff. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. I'm actually going to move back up here so this idea that there are new legal strategies meant to tamp down the kinds of rallies that we saw here in Charlottesville. By and large, they're about disarming people, making sure they can't come with guns and sticks and other kinds of weapons, and also new policing strategies. What happened here in Charlottesville was probably the worst policing model that you could possibly do. Like, it really exacerbated the violence for a lot of reasons that we can talk about if you're interested. But these new strategies actually have done a good job at limiting those kinds of rallies. So you saw, like, a week later in Boston, they tried to put on a rally, nobody showed up. In two places, in Murfreesboro, I think Chattanooga, there were two actually well-organized rallies that were about to go off, but because of these new legal strategies to limit the interaction with counter-protesters and to limit the kind of weaponry you could bring, those actually petered out. So it's effective in stopping that now, so that you don't leave here too optimistic. Charlottesville really fits into a broader story of rising white power terrorism in the United States. And if you've been paying attention in the 2 years since Charlottesville, that has not gone down. We've had the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. We've had arson against mosques and against synagogues. We've seen in New Zealand the international nature of this movement, the global nature of this movement. So Charlottesville is one dot within that broader trend that does not appear to be dissipating at this point.
Yes, you made a comment that kind of surprised me. You said that the events in Charlottesville were no longer about Trump, but yet many of the marchers, the alt-right marchers, the legions that I saw marching, were dressed in his golf attire of white shirt and khaki pants. And then later I've heard different commentators say, or actually participants, admit that they felt emboldened by the dog whistles that Trump was giving to the alt-right. Can you comment on that?
Sure. What I meant by that statement, that this was about making the alt-right about more than just Trump, for much of 2015 and all of 2016, the alt-right's entree into mainstream politics was through the Trump campaign and ultimately through Donald Trump's election. When Donald Trump was elected, they went and they celebrated the deplorable up that coincided with the inauguration. And then they were looking for new, bigger ways that weren't just about Donald Trump and his campaign. So how do we make this even bigger, even more mainstream? And that's when they focused on the statues. There was also a little bit of discontent among the alt-right with Trump's decision to bomb Syria. But no, I mean, all of this has to be understood in the context of rising nationalism in the U.S. more broadly, the way that Trump's election, his promise of a Muslim ban, those sorts of things, emboldened the alt-right, and absolutely the way that in many ways we see the characters that I'm talking about for August 11th and 12th, a lot of their organizations begin to fall apart. Nobody talks about Richard Spencer anymore. Nobody talks about Jason Kessler anymore. But not only has white power terrorism continued, but a lot of those ideas that fueled the alt-right have been mainstreamed into policy. So it might be more diffuse, but those ideas and that activism is still very present.
What are your thoughts and recommendations for this community moving forward?
I think this community has actually done a lot of really hard work over the past 18 months. I know that city council has been incredibly contentious, but one result of all of that contention has been people have continued to talk about white supremacy in all of its forms and how communities can critically engage with white supremacy and be less white supremacist. And I think that that's actually really important work that has been ongoing. I think that the effort to continue to memorialize lynching victims, UVA is doing excellent work on centering the story of slavery at the university. I think that good things are happening. They need to continue to happen. People need to understand that white supremacy doesn't just operate in terms of neo-Nazi marches in the middle of the city, but it is embedded in housing policy, it is embedded in voting policy, it is embedded in refugee policy. Like, all of those things continue to need to be addressed, just as white supremacist violence needs to be addressed. I do think, obviously, the first anniversary was very safe. I'm not sure that putting a fence around the entire city was the best way to reckon with what happened here. So I would hope on the second anniversary, things look and feel different than they did on August 12th, 2018. So that might be one place to look toward. Like, you don't want to feel like you live in a war zone. That wasn't, I don't think, helpful for anyone. And I think it re-triggered a lot of trauma for a lot of people.
The city investigative report, the Tim Heafley report, stated, I believe, that the city failed to protect free speech, and that it kind of implied that the city or the police chief even sort of used violence as a tool to prohibit speech. What are your feelings about that?
So, I mean, the Heafley report concluded that the city had failed to protect free speech because the rally never happened, right? Nobody got to get up and give their speeches. I mean, I still believe that there was a category error about what that event was. It was never really a free speech event, as we saw in the violence the night before. And this is part of the reason why policing was so difficult around it, was because the people who had come to gather here were not primarily interested in speech. They were primarily interested in acts of violence, and they did not see their speech and violence as separate. And they were in many ways using free speech claims as a way of giving themselves the space to engage in those acts of violence. And we know that from the events of August 11th. That said, the city failed on just countless levels. The city had tried to protect free speech by permitting these rallies and permitting the Ku Klux Klan rally in July. And police made a significant number of significant errors, as the Heafley report points out. But one of their errors was, you know, when the KKK came in July, it was a handful of Klansmen and about 2,000 counter-protesters. The numbers were very, very different. And police at that event saw the protesters as the problem. And from that moment on, it set up, what I mean by that is, after the Klan left, the police, in clearing the streets, gassed the protesters, escalated instead of de-escalating conflict, and saw themselves as, look, the Klan isn't causing us any problem, right? It's like 50 guys, they're not causing us a problem, but this crowd control problem with the 2,000 counter protesters, that's what we need to watch for. So as you go into August 12th, you know, the police had been working with the organizers of the Unite the Right rally you know, making sure they had all their permits, telling them when they were going to come in, when they were going to come out. Like, they had a tightly developed plan. So their focus was on the counter protesters. And so as violence begins to break out, there were a lot of problems with how things went. But as violence begins to break out, their attention is on the counter protesters and not on the violent white nationalists who are in the park. Now the police, the biggest mistake the police made is that they encircled the protesters and the white supremacists so that they could go at one another. And then the police kind of had them penned in. In an ideal situation, and what every other city has done since, is they have put the police between protesters and white supremacists. That's what you should do. Also, when the police said, everybody leave, and nobody left, the police didn't do anything. When DeAndre Harris was being beaten in the parking garage, police officers were standing right next door. They didn't do anything. And that failure to act, to actually protect the public safety of the city, that was a failure of city government across the board, and state government for that matter. I mean, the VSP was here. They didn't do their job either. Like, it was a badly mismanaged day, and that mismanagement led to a lot of injuries, a lot of trauma, and the loss of life.
This is sort of a minor question, but I deal in words. And every time I turn around, there's a picture of the statues. Every time I turn around, there's a picture of the conflagration in the downtown, even if it's talking about something in another town. And if we keep having these pictures, and I'm not saying get rid of the statues or keep the statues, but it seems that a lot of this pictorial stuff aggravates it.
Yes, I agree with it. I mean, if you Google Charlottesville and go to the image results, you are not going to see all of these, like, lovely picturesque. Sorry, I got to get all the way back to the picturesque stuff. Like, you're not going to see, like, picturesque Charlottesville scenes. You're not going to see the downtown mall. You're just going to see a proliferation of violence. I don't know what we can do about that. You know, obviously, when I talk about it, we have to use the pictures. But, like, that they become a stand-in for all kinds of violence. I think that it's not great, but I also think that it's incredibly hard on the citizens of Charlottesville. And it's interesting, you're all Charlottesvillians. Like, our experience was very different from the rest of the world and continues to be very different from the rest of the world's in terms of how we understood and experienced this day, at least for people who were on the ground on August 11th and 12th. Even just that experience of everyone else using Charlottesville as shorthand for August 12th. Right, as the city becomes a hashtag for those of us who talk about Charlottesville every day. Like, it's weird to have those conversations with people for whom, when they say Charlottesville, they don't mean the city, this community, they mean that act of terroristic violence. And that's just a different experience for us. And I think it's why those photos often are more noticeable to us and have a bigger impact.
I have two comments. Where is the bench? With John Henry, you didn't identify where the bench could be seen. And the second one, I think there's something to do with religion here, because on the August the 11th, the torchlight went around the chapel on the campus, and it was filled with people inside praying, and they were hitting the windows, the doors, and everything. And then the temple had moved their most holy sacred things out of the temple, and they asked the city of Charlottesville for police protection, and the city said no. And the people, the agitators, were right on the sidewalk outside the temple.
Yeah. So to the first question, I don't know. I know that, like, his lynching happened over by the country club. And for the second question about religion is a huge part of the anti-racist activism that happened in Charlottesville. I'm gonna mix up their names, but Congregate Seville and the Seville Clergy Collective. The Clergy Collective is formed in 2015 after Dylann Roof shot up the church in Charleston, South Carolina. And the idea was, if this happens in one of our churches, how are we going to respond as a faith community? And so that became a new interfaith alliance. In 2017, they start the Clergy Collective, which was a more overtly anti-racist organization. But it is one that is very deeply seated in the religious life of Charlottesville. So members of the clergy, the rabbis at the synagogue, all of these people were involved in organizing anti-racist protests over the course of the Summer of Hate and were on the front lines on August 11th, being in the church. As you may know, gun threats were called into 911 as that church service was going on. Somebody had called in saying they had an automatic weapon and they were going to shoot up the church. So the church was on lockdown. And of course, the white supremacists marched by the church and threatened the synagogue regularly over the course of the summer, and especially on August 12th. So it is both the case that the clergy were on the front lines of organizing against hate in Charlottesville, and that they were in many ways on the front lines as targets of that day, particularly the synagogue, which hired a security guard for the first time during the summer and has had it ever since. I was talking to, Risa Golubov, who's the dean of Notre Dame Law, or of UVA Law, and she was saying how she had gone to Germany a few summers ago, and she'd taken her family, and they had gone to the synagogue, and as the rabbi was leaving the synagogue, he takes off all of his gear, and they're like, well, why are you doing that? And he's like, well, we don't want to wear Jewish-identifying clothing outside of the synagogue. It can be dangerous. And there was a security guard there, and Risa commented that she remembered thinking at the time, How different it is to be in Europe where you can't be openly Jewish, and how great it was to come back to Charlottesville. And she came back to Charlottesville and she worried about sending her son downtown in Jewish identifying clothing. And a security guard was posted any time that there were people in the synagogue. And it really has changed life for Jewish people in Charlottesville. And then after the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre, for Jews all over the country.
In part of your comments, if I understood you correctly, you stated that the evening, the Friday evening in which the torchlight took place there on the grounds, that the University of had administration did not have any indication that this was going to take place, if I understood your comments correctly. I thought there had been right much commentary that there was prior notice, and could the administration have taken any advance precautions on that particular night?
Yes, so that's a great question, and I'm really glad you're giving me the chance to clarify. When I said no prior notification and no authorization, I meant that the organizers of the Unite the Right rally had not told the police ahead of time that this was going to happen. They had permitted the stuff on the 12th, but they hadn't done anything on the 11th. The university absolutely knew that this was going to happen. They had warning as early as Wednesday. Larry Sabato inadvertently in his comments to me made clear that Teresa Sullivan had known good and well that this was coming on that Friday, and they didn't do anything about it. They didn't clear students off of campus, and nor did the police officers on campus do anything to protect those students. I mean, we'll just talk about failures all day. This was a real failure of the university governance, because one of the primary purposes of a city government is to keep its people safe. One of the primary projects of a university is to keep its students safe. And here they had been told that white supremacists were coming onto campus, had planned this torchlight march, and they did nothing to protect their students. And in fact, later then Sullivan said that she didn't know, when the evidence is clear that she did. That's a real failure, and I think that it's led to a lot of broken trust between students and the administration. Now, of course, Teresa Sullivan has moved on, but I think that those failures point to a broader failure in American society to take seriously the violence that underwrites white supremacy. That white supremacy is ultimately a violent set of beliefs and will become violent when given the space to. And that's what we saw here. And what we saw was that city leadership and university leadership and police leadership did not consider it a violent threat. And we saw what happened when they were underestimated.
Yes, Edgar Gunter. I'm actually a retired professor at the University of Virginia. It was quite disgraceful what happened. Larry Sabato said that's the worst thing that ever happened. But I'd like to give you some insight of why we think August 12th went so badly. My friend Kathy lives two blocks from the Lee statue. We found ourselves in both riots. We were right there. In the first one, we were was very well organized with several inside the Jackson Park. And so the people came in, the older men with their outfits, and they were there for about half an hour. Then the state police escorted them out. Now, at that rally, you had state police in riot gear. And we watched it after the Klan had left. The people that were protesting went against the police in riot gear. Larry Pleasance, Captain Pleasance at that time, against orders, ordered the tear gas to be thrown. And so they threw 2 to 3 cans of tear gas against the people that were attacking the police. 22 people were arrested. They were all eventually let go. But at the next city council meeting, our own professor, you know her, Jelaine Schmidt, associate professor of history, took an empty tear gas can and threw it at the council and declared police brutality. So at the next, at August 12th, there was no police in riot gear. We went out August the 11th that night to see what was going on in Lee Park. They're putting the fencing around the park, nothing to separate the people there. The other thing, we saw 12 guys come in with white shirts and khaki pants with unlit tiki torches. They saw 12 police there. They came in and went out. We said, who are these guys? What the hell is going on here? Because they were going to light the torches at Lee Park. Mm-hmm. So what happened, we had a failure on the state police, the local police, and our own university because they were afraid to go in riot gear. We were there and marched with the people that came in. They had AR-15 rifles. Mm-hmm. We were lucky nobody was shot. They were armed to the hilt. We walked on the other side as they came in downtown. It was very scary. We were lucky there was not a bloodbath.
No, it was terrifying. And the people in those white shirts and khaki pants, I believe that's the uniform of Vanguard America, which is a neo-Nazi group. I just want to say there were police in riot gear on August 12th, and so they might not have been on the scene at that time. Yeah, because they come out like later on during the day. But yes, I mean the policing was a tragedy all summer.
I gather from the speech and from what I've heard that the hope of getting rid of these statues is dead.
So that is a good question. The issue right now is that there is a state law that says that war memorials can only be moved under if the state government votes that they should be removed. And so what that and then a judge declared these were war memorials. Questionable, but that was what was decided by the courts. And so, yes, right now under the current way that the state government is comprised, that's the case. If Democrats were to take over both the House and the Senate here in Virginia, then you could see that state law change. What people have asked for is essentially a return of local control for local statuary. And if that is the case, if that law passes, then you would imagine that city council would move fairly quickly to take the statues down. That's no easy feat. There's like 8 feet of concrete in the ground. Right. Like there's a reason why these statues aren't being toppled by activists. Like they're really hard to remove. So it's going to take a lot of money too. But given especially the way that they have become not just markers of white supremacy from the 1920s, but markers of white supremacy from 2017, I think there will still be a popular movement to remove them.
Could we add counter statues to them?
Yeah, that's something that's been talked about quite a lot. I'm going to forget people's names off the top of my head, but I talked with somebody in the architecture school who had come up with this like huge plan for like turning that into kind of an outdoor museum about like enslavement and white nationalism and all those kinds of things. So in the case that you cannot remove these statues, the next best step is to put them into context. Now, they're still... you know, they're still sitting up on big pedestals. There is a power to just them being there at that height and on, like, it's difficult to counter that message with little plaques that explain what white supremacy is. Yeah, so it would have to be big, or they, one option that John Mason, the professor of history at UVA and also the head of the Blue Ribbon Commission, had suggested was you could also take them off their pedestals. And if you could take down the pedestal and keep the memorial and have it at eye level, then you could do much more interactive stuff that would take away some of the visual power of the statues.
This is more of a comment than a question. August of 2017. September, October, and November of 2017, we were in Australia and a little bit of Indonesia. Everywhere we went, when we said we were from the United States, the question was where? We said Virginia. Oh, where? Charlottesville. The publicity we got was worldwide. Mm-hmm. And what they know and remember is exactly what they saw of Annette. They don't know a thing about what they're doing now or what's been, but we'll never recover from that initial shock that people saw around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's right. I went to Hawaii the month after and was on a kayak with someone from Britain, and it was the exact same thing. They were like, Charlottesville. It's like, yeah. Now, look, I mean, people's associations fade over time. It's, you know, if we hear about Charleston, we don't necessarily immediately think about the shooting at the AME church there. But it is a thing that happened in the city, and it is a thing that wasn't just incidental that it happened in the city. And I think that that's important. And I think that there's only so much that the city can do to erase that image. I think that the more important work that the city needs to do is to help to cultivate a culture in which that doesn't happen here again.
Yes. Would you comment on the organization of the counter-protesters, the Antifas? Because I saw some of them coming up in their riot gear, nine o'clock in the morning. They were coming to fight.
Yeah,
but
so
to fight.
Yeah, so there were a wide range of counter-protesters of all different kinds of beliefs about how best to stand up to white supremacists. You had a large pacifist contingent that was largely organizing the clergy collective. They had hoped to have enough people that they could encircle the park and not allow the white supremacists in to practice nonviolent resistance. But anti-fascists believe that violence is a legitimate tool in the toolkit for stopping fascism and white power terrorism. And this has been a fascinating debate to watch play out. Because you had organizations like the Redneck Revolt, which is an anti-fascist militia, came armed, was there to provide defense. And that does escalate violence in a place. Their argument is that fascism is inherently violent and has to be met with violence, that if more people had stood up and violently suppressed fascism in places like Germany and Italy and France, that it would have stopped. They point to violence against fascists in Britain as a way of preventing fascists from overtaking Britain in the 1930s. I don't really know what to make of those arguments. I know that they're live arguments. I was just on a panel this weekend on violence and political history, and one of the women was talking about her newest book, which is about the way that Black women abolitionists use violence to free themselves and to battle back against enslavement. When is violence a legitimate tool? When is it not? Was it legitimate for abolitionists to use violence against slaveholders? Was it legitimate for colonists to use violence against the British government? Like, what violence do we consider legitimate and what violence don't we? And that's actually a really fascinating question that anti-fascists have put it on the table, and I don't have a good answer for it. I think that it, though, is a really difficult question for folks to grapple with.
Thank you. Just wanted to find out if you had heard or seen Charlene Green. I'm not sure of, so she's with the city of Charlottesville, don't know her title, but she does a wonderful presentation on the history of Charlottesville that encompasses a lot of what you're covering and talks about from an education perspective, medical, political, economic, the history of African Americans in the community, and the history that we've told and not told about that. And she gives that regularly around the area, so that would be a good person if you're interested in more about this subject for you or anybody, I think, to be able to hear.
I mean, I just barely scratched the surface in order to like paint a little bit of a picture, but the history of Charlottesville is absolutely fascinating. And the more that you dig into it, the more you find from the eugenics program over at UVA, which has been central to Buck v. Bell and other eugenics legislation or eugenics rulings from the Supreme Court, to the thriving variety of communities who have lived in Charlottesville over the centuries. Like, it's a fascinating place with a fascinating history, and we should tell more of it. We should tell all of it because it's all so interesting, and we don't actually accurately reckon with the past until we've told that whole story.
You mentioned a few times the Vanguard group.
Yeah.
Is this like a chapter, and if so, how many different groups are there?
There are so many, sorry to say, there are so many different groups. Vanguard America is one group that is on the more violent neo-Nazi edge. It is nationwide and connected with groups in other countries. But if you looked at the consent decrees that were struck after, this is an answer to the question too about ways to prevent this kind of violence, there were consent decrees that were struck with every armed group that came on August 11th and 12th to Charlottesville, including Redneck Revolt and the anti-fascist groups, but about like 16 organized armed white supremacist groups. Those consent decrees said basically like, we're not going to come back with weapons. And that's really important. We should have more of those consent decrees. The problem is that, so to take for instance, the Traditional Workers' Party, which had been one of the major neo-Nazi violent groups that was here in Charlottesville on the 11th and 12th, their organization collapsed in early 2018. But their members are now parts of different groups. Like, this is a Hydra-headed thing, right? Like, you cut off the head and two more heads spring up. Like, you're not necessarily going to end white power organizing by getting rid of any one group. So there will always be different groups. There will be terror cells, like I've talked about. But yes, so there are many, many groups. They tend to be internecine. They tend to fight one another. They tend to fall apart, but they reorganize. There are different degrees of violence. That's actually really important. One of the things that the alt-right had been trying to do in its early days, especially after Trump was elected, they were like, here's our chance to be politically viable, and we're not going to be politically viable if we're wearing swastikas and shooting people. They went back to that. But the idea that you can mainstream the ideas, there are certain groups that want to do that, but they always, because people are attracted to fascism because of the violence, like they inevitably dissolve into violence. This happened with the Proud Boys, who had tried to assert themselves as a nonviolent alt-right group, and then they go to New York and they attack people in the streets of New York, and it's just like, okay, you're violent. You can't control it, or you won't control it. Yeah, that was a rambling answer, but
you may have touched on this, and the one gentleman also mentioned it, but I watched the white nationalists strapping on military gear. I mean, they were in full combat gear with AR-15s, knee pads, sidearms, and they were ready to go. And you said you didn't want to live in a combat zone, but those of us that saw that, we were in a combat zone with two-man firing teams patrolling the streets of Charlottesville, who were not the police or the authorities. They were white nationalist militants. Now, my question is, has that been addressed on a formal way by the authorities, the civil authorities, to prevent that? You mentioned some of the groups said they wouldn't come back with that kind of combat gear strapped on, but we can't leave it to them to solve this.
Sure. So, yes, the consent decrees were very much focused on groups that presented as militias. This was Mary McCord and Philip Zelikow's strategy that they developed in the 1970s to attack white power, to dismantle white power militias, that if you are wearing a uniform and you are armed, you are presenting yourself as a militia, and we actually have laws against that. Like, we can do something about the fact that you're presenting yourself that way. I mean, I think that the one thing that I would say is that none of these were just random events, right? These were planned attacks on the city that had been happening with the foreknowledge of people in the community, in the anti-fascist organizing community, the foreknowledge of the police. We all knew that these things were coming. It's not that these armed militia groups suddenly swept into town in the dead of night and surprised everyone. That's not what we have to fear, I don't think. Which is why it seemed like over-policing on the one-year anniversary, because we could tell you exactly where all of those groups were going to be, because we know where all of those groups were. We knew some of them were in Washington, D.C. We knew that they weren't necessarily planning to come back to Charlottesville, and that a small police contingent actually could have... we didn't need a big gate thrown up around the city. There are some laws to regulate militias that have been effective.
Our president asked me to remind you that our next meeting of senior statesmen of Virginia is on August 14. I hope it will be as interesting as the one today. thank you very much.
Thank you so much.